Hello, everyone. This is Bill Murphy. I'm here with the front pages for Friday, March 5th. I'll be reading from the New York Times. I have a couple articles from the Times and then the rest from the Hartford Current. And we'll take a look at the pictures on the front pages of the papers. Picture on the front page of the Times, a lady named Brianna Hernandez. This is happening in East Los Angeles. She's the manager and apprentice embalmer in the chapel lobby of the Continental Funeral Home in East Los Angeles. And he's kind of a sad picture here. She's pushing, looks like a casket off to the side. And on the background, if I'm looking at this, all right, there's, if I'm looking at this correctly, there are four bodies. They're all, of course, all wrapped up and on the shelf. So we're going to read that story. It won't be a pleasant one, but we're going to read that. First, the other picture, well, we're going to go right over to the Current. That's the main picture on the Times. Over in the Current, here's a picture of a educator. Her name is Kim Brown Green. She's from Glastonbury East Hartford Magnet School, and she's giving the thumbs up after receiving her first dose of COVID-19 vaccine Thursday from a firefighter paramedic, Manchester native. His name is John Medinsky. This happens in Glastonbury. And there's a picture of her at the table, and she's about to, I guess she's already received the shot or about to, got her thumbs up and her face mask on. In the background, there's a table with all the other people that are coming in to get their shots, lining up to go through the protocols before they receive their shots. So those are the two pictures, the main pictures on both papers. We're going to read that story now from East Los Angeles on the front page of the New York Times about the funeral homes. The chapel at Continental Funeral Home was once a place where the living remembered the dead. Now the pews, chairs, and furniture have been pushed aside to make room in the dead far outnumber the living. On a Thursday afternoon last month in Continental's chapel in East Los Angeles, across the street from a 7-Eleven, there were four bodies in cardboard boxes. I guess that's the the lady is pushing off to the side there when I describe the picture. Seven wrapped in white and pink sheets on wheeled stretchers, and 18 in closed coffins where the pews used to be, and 31 on the shelves of racks against the walls. The math numbed the heart as much as the mind. 62 bodies. Elsewhere at Continental, in the hallways beyond the chapel and the trailers outside, there were even more. "I have a nightmare every day," said Magna Maldonado, 58, the owner of the funeral home. "It's a crisis, a deep crisis. When somebody calls me, I beg them for patience. Please be patient," I say. "That's all I'm asking you, because nothing is normal these days." Funeral homes are places America often prefers to ignore. As the coronavirus pandemic surged in Los Angeles in recent months, the industry went into disaster mode, quietly and anonymously dealing with mass death on a scale for which it was unprepared and ill-equipped. And like most funeral homes in Queens and Brooklyn, New York, in the spring, or in South Texas in the summer, funeral homes in parts of Los Angeles have become bellish symbols of COVID-19's toll. Continental, the funeral home, has been one of the most overwhelmed funeral homes in the country. Its location at the center of the Southern California coronavirus spike, its popularity with working-class Mexican and Mexican-American families who have been disproportionately affected by COVID-19, its decision to expand its storage capacity, all have combined to turn the day-to-day into a careful dance of controlled chaos. For more than 6 weeks, a reporter and a photographer, were allowed by Ms. Maldonado, her employees, and the relatives of those who died to document the inner workings of the mortuary and the heartache of funeral after funeral after funeral. Beverly Hills has had 32 deaths. Santa Monica has had 150. East Los Angeles, an unincorporated part of Los Angeles County that is one of the largest Mexican-American communities in the United States, has had 388. And with more than 52,000 virus-related deaths, California has recorded the most of any state but about average per capita is continental. The brutal reality of the death toll hits the gut first, the eyes second. At the entrance of the chapel lobby, look first to the left, four bodies under white sheets on hard store style metal shelves. That's what I described in the picture, originally designed to hold something other than human lives. Next to those four were another four, and more in the middle and more to the right. The 31 bodies on the shelves rested on plywood and cardboard beds, their heads on styrofoam block pillows. The racks were so tall in one corner that the final of an ornate chandelier was clearing it by inches. Bodies in coffins were rolled out. Bodies in stretchers were rolled in. Their uniformity was disrupted by the smallest details, a tuft of a woman's long black hair spilling out of the top of her sheets, a right foot. We don't know how the public will see it, but it was necessary, Ms. Maldonado said, of the chapel's conversion. Need brought us to improvise. We're in America, so we suppose that we are prepared for everything. But in this emergency that we had, we were not. And I'm going to stop there with that article. And another article, this is on the national page of the New York Times. Actually, it's the starts in the front page of the Times and goes on to the national page. In the summer of 1936, Theodore Geisel, that's G-E-I-S-E-L, was on a ship from Europe to New York. When he started scribbling silly rhymes on the ship's stationery to entertain himself during a storm. And this is a story that no one can beat. I saw it all happen on Mulberry Street. The rhymes morphed into his first children's book, and to think that I saw it on Mulberry Street about a boy who witnesses increasingly outlandish things. First published in 1937, the book started Geisel's career as Dr. Seuss. He went on to publish more than 60 books and have sold some 700 million copies globally, making him one of the world's most enduringly popular children's book authors. But some aspects of Seuss's work have not aged well, including his debut, which features a crude racial stereotype of an Asian man with slanted lines for eyes. Mulberry Street was one of six of his books that the Seuss estate said it would stop selling this week after concluding that the egregious racial and ethnic stereotypes in the works are hurtful and wrong. The announcement seemed to drive a surge of support for Seuss classics. Dozens of his books shot to the top of Amazon's print bestseller list. On Thursday morning, nine of the site's top 10 bestsellers were Seuss books. The estate's decision, which prompted breathless headlines on cable news and complaints about cancel culture from prominent conservatives, represents a dramatic step to update and curate Seuss's body of work, acknowledging and rejecting some of his views while seeking to protect his brand and appeal. It also raises questions about whether and how an author's works should be posthumously curated to reflect evolving social attitudes and what should be preserved as part of the cultural record. It will cause people to reevaluate the legacy of Dr. Seuss, and I think that's a good thing, said Philip Nell, a children's literature scholar at Kansas State University and the author of Dr. Seuss, American Icon. There are parts of his legacy one should honor and parts of his legacy that one should not. He added, they may be motivated by the fact that racism is bad for the brand, or they may be motivated by a deeper sense of racial justice. Classic children's books are perennial bestsellers, an important revenue stream for publishers. Last year, more than 380,000 copies of Green Eggs and Ham were sold across the United States, according to an NPD book scan, which tracks the sale of physical books at most retailers. One Fish, Two Fish, Red Fish, Blue Fish sold more than 311,000 copies, and Oh, the Places You'll Go, always a popular as a high school graduation gift, sold more than 513,000 copies. And to think that I saw it on Mulberry Street, one of the six books pulled by the estate, sold about 5,000 copies last year, according to BookScan. McGillicuddy's Pool and The Cat's Quizzer haven't sold in years, though the retailer's BookScan tracks through them rather, putting the merits of the books aside, removing green eggs and ham would be a completely different business proposition from doing away with new printings of McGilligan's Pool. Dr. Seuss is perhaps the most beloved children's book author to come under criticism for outdated and insensitive depictions of racial, ethnic, cultural, and gender differences. In recent decades, librarians and scholars have led a push to reevaluate children's classics that contain stereotypes and caricatures. Editions of illustrated series like Tintin and Babar, which have long been accused of promoting colonialist and imperialist viewpoints, have been withdrawn from some libraries following criticism that their European authors depicted non-white characters as savages. Children's publishers and literary estates are trying to walk a delicate line by preserving an author's legacy while recognizing and rejecting aspects of a writer's work that are out of step with current social and cultural values. We'll stop there with that article, and we're going to move over now to the Hartford Current for the rest of our stories. And the first one I have is, I'm going to spend a lot of time on this because there's a lot of information here. The state is rolling back restrictions. Governor Ned Lamont Thursday announced that he will roll back coronavirus pandemic-related restrictions in Connecticut starting March 19th, including allowing restaurants to operate at full capacity, loosening rules on sports and entertainment venues, and lifting the state's travel ban. The state will maintain some key measures, including a mask mandate, social distancing rules, a curfew for restaurants, and the closure of all bars. Restaurants, retail stores, houses of worship, and other businesses will be allowed to reopen at full capacity within the confines of the remaining rules. Sports will be allowed to resume fully with outdoor venues permitted up to 50% capacity, capped at 10,000 visitors, and indoor venues permitted up to 10,000 capacity. Travelers will still be recommended to quarantine after arriving in Connecticut, but they will not be required to do so. Most of the new changes will take effect on March 19th, with several more following over the subsequent 2 weeks. The reopening anticipates a summer that approaches something more normal, with outdoor concerts, ball games, and weddings, along with reduced travel restrictions. We wanted to emphasize that which works and that which is enforceable, Lamont said at his Thursday afternoon press briefing. And we know that words is the mask, and we know that what works is social distancing, and we know that curfew is something we can enforce. Lamont emphasized that Connecticut has not gone as far as Mississippi and Texas, states which drew sharp criticism from President Joe Biden after revoking their mask mandates. This is not Texas. This is not Mississippi. This is Connecticut, Lamont said. We are maintaining the masks. Still, Connecticut's new plan defies guidance from Rochelle Walensky, director of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, who recommended earlier this week that states move slowly in reopening. When asked about his decision-making process, Lamont said he looked at other states' reopening approaches. Massachusetts, for instance, recently announced a similar reopening plan, including lifting capacity caps at restaurants. Lamont said his administration received input on the reopening plan from other governors, from a White House response team, from hospital officials and healthcare experts, and from his own advisors. What was it, unanimous? No, Lamont said. Some said, why not wait? Why not wait? There are variants we don't know exactly, but we could wait. But I think there was general consensus that we know what works. We know we have capacity at our hospitals. We know we can turn and change if we have to. Asked about the state's reopening plan, Dr. David Banach, an epidemiologist at UConn Health, said that while he recognizes the need to loosen restrictions, the state must remain vigilant about social distancing and mask wearing. We need to move carefully and cautiously with these measures, Banach said. As we move forward, we need to be very attentive to what's happening around us and prepare in case we need to roll back. Okay, I'm going to go through the different scenarios here of what's going to be less restricted. Start with the restaurants. Beginning on March 19th, Connecticut restaurants will be permitted to move from 50% capacity to 100% capacity with social distancing and mask requirements still in place. Tyler Burrell, Director of Operations at Bear's Restaurant Group, which has locations in Hartford, Windsor, South Windsor, and New Haven, said the capacity increase won't affect us as much as the consumer having more confidence. We're hoping for maybe more offices opening up, more small gatherings happening, so we could get a few big catering orders. That's a part of this business that we miss. Secondly, offices, gyms, houses of worship can all reopen. Retail stores, offices, houses of worship, gyms, libraries, person services such as nail and hair salons will all be allowed to reopen at full capacity on March 19th. Masks and social distancing will be required. If people can telecommunicate, you don't need to have everybody in there, but you can go back appropriately, Lamont said of offices. Tom Phelan, president of the Connecticut Retail Merchants Association, said it was a welcome change. The state's revised plan will permit retail business and communities across our state to return closer to normal operations. Movie theaters and performing arts venues will remain at 50% capacity limit, a requirement that has left them largely shut down. Weddings and other private gatherings. Beginning March 19th, the state will expand private gathering limits to 25 people indoors and 100 people outdoors. Currently, the state caps gatherings at private residences to 10 people, both indoors and outdoors. Also on March 19th, private gatherings at commercial venues will also be expanded to a maximum of 100 people indoors and 200 people outdoors, up from 25 indoors and 50 outdoors currently. And that means that weddings, along with other events, will be permitted to expand to 100 people indoors and 200 people outdoors. Travel restriction lifted. Under the reopening plan, Lamont is also lifting the mandate behind the current travel advisory, meaning that the travel advisory is still in place as recommended guidance, but won't be enforced with fines or other punitive measures. For several months, Connecticut's travel advisory has required a 10-day quarantine or a negative COVID-19 test for anyone traveling from out of state. The only exceptions were for travelers coming from New Jersey, New York, and Rhode Island under agreements Lamont made with those states' governors. High school sports. Lamont's reopening plan also significantly opens up the playing field for sports teams. According to Lamont's plan, all sports teams will be allowed to fully practice and compete, including in tournaments, beginning on March 19th. Lamont's administration says sports will still be subject to guidance from the State Department of Public Health. The Yard Goats and the Travelers Championship. As of April 2nd, indoor sports venues will be allowed to open at 10% capacity, and outdoor event venues will be able to increase to 50% capacity, capped at 10,000 people. This will allow a substantial number of fans to return to Dunkin' Donuts Park for Yard Goats games, to TPC River Highlands for the Travelers Championship, the Hartford Athletic, and more. The official Yard Goats Twitter account tweeted Thursday in response to the news, "Dust off your beer, bat, we're coming." And a couple more here, classrooms and summer camps. The reopening plan also allows early childhood classrooms to increase from a capacity of 16 to 20 students beginning on March 20th. Outdoor amusement parks will be allowed to reopen on April 2nd in preparation for the summer months. And while summer camps and festivals have not yet been given the green light, the reopening plan advises them to begin preparations for an eventual reopening. And finally, emergency powers expiring soon. Lamont's emergency powers are set to expire April 20th, but the governor said Thursday some of his executive orders, such as masking, will likely need to be continued beyond April 20th. The governor implied that he does not plan to extend his emergency powers, but that he will work with the legislature on those issues. My instinct, assuming those things are all true and our infection rate continues to be under control, whatever I wanted to continue, we wanted to continue together post April 20th. We do in collaboration with the legislature, Lamont said.